is Rex. He's an aviation and computer expert, nearly three decades in the air, instrument-rated multi-engine plane, investigator or extraordinaire, talking about the strange downing of Loretta Fuddy's plane. And we're going to be getting into all of the intricacies of this, why it matters today. The reason it matters is we have the same people behind this. This is the same template, whether you're talking about, in my view anyway, you're talking about the orchestration of the cover-up of Kennedy, or, I mean, take it all the way up to present day. You are seeing the same players in many cases, especially of the most recent events, the same template. Now,
and this is a very detailed,
yes,
insightful look as to the mechanisms and ways that go about changing a narrative, covering up facts, and hiding the truth.
Indeed. Now, again, folks, Hagman and Hagman.com for show information, and HagmanReport.com, where there's going to be some there's going to be a recap done of this at the conclusion of this investigative exclusive here. Now, I just want to remind everyone, if you're listening to this and you don't have any computer in front of you or any way to look at this, you can go to YouTube after hours, and or when you have a chance, and you can take a look at the stills. Again, our guest is Rex, talking about Loretta Fuddy. And now, she was the gatekeeper of the Obama birth certificate, and we know that there was a lot of funny business with respect to that, regardless of who says what. We have not seen anything demonstrable, any type of demonstrable proof about Obama's bona fides. Now, what happened to Loretta Fuddy? Ostensibly, she was killed, or she died as a result of a heart attack stemming from a plane crash on December 11, 2013. We're here to tell you that ain't the case. Not the case at all. Rex, I'm going to bring you back on, and we're just talking here. This is in our opinion. This is an investigative analysis based on our professional opinion, your investigative opinion. This is all opinion. So if you want to definitely talk and name names and companies, feel free to do so. I mean, I think we're not making any accusations. We're just showing the facts as we found them, or as you found them. So having said that, the restraints are off. Folks, put your seat backs and tray tables in their full upright lock position, because here we go. And I'll kick it back to you, sir.
Yes, well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. If we could find image 11 and bring that up on the screen, that'll be good. But it pertains to an interview of the pilot at his company's offices on the Honolulu airport. And it was several days after the crash. And he told the press some very interesting things. He said, "All I know is bang, and I had an unseater panel that was nothing but red and yellow lights. Fire warning was going off."
Rex, on the top of the? Oh, there it is. Okay.
Image 11, if you can find that.
It's actually slide 13 on this, but okay, we got it.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Fine. Okay, so, if as a pilot you look at that kind of a statement, there's a lot to be said behind that. That is, particularly when you say the fire warning was going off, bang, that means for a pilot, let's look at our emergency procedures. And did the pilot follow those? Well, we're looking on the next page, which is I have as an image or figure 12. There's a smoke and fire emergency procedures checklist citation, and that's very relevant here. If the fire warning is going off, you darn well better deal with emergency procedures of smoke and fire. So that citation of the pilot's operating handbook tells us that we need to do some things as a pilot. So it says power lever goes to idle, prop control lever goes to feather, fuel condition lever goes to cutoff, fuel shutoff goes to off, and so forth. Now, the pilot apparently didn't do that. If you look at the NTSB report, it says that after this so-called catastrophic engine failure and stoppage of his engine, he verified that his fuel valves were on. Well, that's a very unusual statement. If you have fuel valves and you are interested in their condition after hearing a fire warning, you darn well better be turning them off rather than leaving them on. And he said he was verifying that they were on. Well, if they had been off, either one or both, there would have been a warning horn activated, and an annunciator panel light would have come on. So verifying that the fuel valves were on really shouldn't have taken very much time at all. That is, if you don't hear the warning horn, if you don't see the annunciator panel light, those fuel valves are on. But they should be off, by the way. The pilot should be turning them off, and yet that's not what he does at all. He tells the U.S. Coast Guard, which if we have the right slide up, which in my numbering is number 12. Yes, you've got it. Thank you. At the bottom of that page or slide, beginning with the word Honolulu, and highlighted by these words, after his second attempt to restart, the engine failed. Well, apparently the pilot has told the U.S. Coast Guard that he tried to make two engine restart attempts, and they both failed. That's quite something. If you have smoke and fire procedures in front of you, which you should, as certainly as an 18,000-hour pilot, you ought to be turning everything off that has fuel involved with it, because makes there sense. Could be major structural damage. You could make a huge fire, potentially. And it says in the underlying portion there, in the, say, the middle, one of the underlying pieces is an engine restart should not be attempted. So very clearly, the evidence that the pilot is representing or has represented to the U.S. Coast Guard is very much against what the pilot's operating handbook would have us do. And furthermore, without the NTSB making any complaint or saying that it's a problem, he's verified to the NTSB that the fuel valves were on. Well, like so many of the things that are wrong with this scenario, like the various altitude claims of where this catastrophic engine failure occurred, the NTSB makes not a peep whatsoever that this or that was a problem. But it was. And they had the evidence in hand, just as I've had, video-wise, for example, in this case, to show that the pilot was not right in saying either 300 feet or 500 feet, or what he was doing in the case of a fire warning going off, determining that the fuel valves were on. The NTSB report doesn't say anomalously or incorrectly or against the pilot's operating handbook, which, frankly, I would think would be very relevant to a crash investigation. And this is not just one thing. I've got a litany of at least 10 things here that are different between what the pilot said he did, what the operating handbook and everything else says you should be doing, and the video evidence confirms that what he had said was not what he did. So there's all of these evidences of things being incorrect or misrepresentations being made that are unresolved, even in the NTSB report. They choose not to address themselves to these anomalies, which, as I say, a pilot being coming from the aviation community, these are huge red flags. And maybe there's an answer for it somewhere, but it didn't appear in the NTSB report, and there are contradictions left and right.
All right.
So
as a pilot, though, the pilot said, all I know is bang, and I had an annunciator panel that was nothing but red and yellow lights, and fire warnings was going off. As a pilot, you're going to automatically and instinctively do a series of things in your head and put them to practice. Pilot did not. In fact, did the opposite in some
That's
cases.
That's right.
All right.
Yes. Didn't. I mean, he may have jumped into action, but the actions we see him jumping into are not the right actions at all. And
for a fire.
It's not up to me. It's the pilot operating handbook is very clear about these things.
Right. All right. So we see that, okay, and that, folks, is just one of many inconsistencies. And so you've got the pilot saying what he did. You got the handbook saying what to do. And you have the conditions under which the pilot said he had to do the things because of the fire or whatever. And then you've got the forensic evidence, and all of them are inconsistent with each other. So, all right.
Yes, yes. So maybe we can move to the next slide, which says... in red near the top was loud like a metal hammer. That was a passenger in the first row saying that, and that amounts to a mechanical noise that's also mentioned in the emergency procedures pilot's operating handbook for the Cessna Grand Caravan. And it says there an engine failure might be evidenced by mechanical noises, and the big red box caution one bit below that says, do not attempt to restart an engine that is definitely known to have failed. Well, if you have a loud metal-like hammer and the engine completely stops, let me tell you, that's a mechanical noise, and it's a mechanical failure, and an engine restart should never have been attempted. But a pilot such as myself says he's got more thousands of hours more than I have. How come he didn't know that? Or at least, why wasn't he responding in a way that the rest of the aviation community would think prudent and just the normal thing? So those question marks are just big in our minds.
Okay.
And then we can move maybe to the next slide after that.
All right. And the next slide is titled, "The Pilot Does Not Follow Ditching Emergency Checklist."
Right, right.
Okay.
That's another thing. The very first one there is what is called in shorthand a mayday. That is, if you have a pilot emergency, you're supposed to generally try to make a mayday call on this emergency frequency 121.5, give your intentions, squawk 7000 or 7700, and so forth. That's very important, especially in a remote area, so that people who might be able to hear you can come rescue you. That's huge. That's number one on the list. And yet, the pilot claims, and has made the claim to, I believe, both the NTSB and the U.S. Coast Guard, that he made such a mayday call. And yet, what happens when a pilot makes a mayday call on that frequency? All the red lights in all the FAA and other air traffic control facilities go red. You'll see the red lights come on everywhere just by keying the mic for that frequency. And it would not have been missed. No one would miss that mayday call.
Right.
And furthermore, planes who are flying overhead, particularly airliners, are very much habitual about tuning an extra radio to 121.5 just in case they can be helpful to a fellow pilot who might be in need. And we know that there were several aircraft in the area that were tuned so to 121.5 because within a minute or two after this, or actually even before, you'd have to say that is these aircraft in the area heard an ELT, that is an emergency locator transmitter, going off, which means the pilot has had a crash of some kind, and they reported that immediately. And yet, this mayday that was claimed before the aircraft hit the ocean was not recorded by anyone. So you'd have to say there is no evidence for any mayday other than the pilot's claim. And that's very anomalous. That's very unlike an 18,000-hour pilot would do.
Now, let me ask you this. Well, hold on a second. Let me ask you. Would there be a reason, a nefarious reason, why a pilot would not want to give a mayday because of perhaps documenting certain things, or I mean, I guess
yes,
my question
I could
is
say
why
that.
Wasn't it?
I could. In this case, which is difficult to do with as little evidence as we've laid out so far, but the evidence in its totality would eventually support this. That is that maybe the pilot wanted to leave the rescue in certain hands. There is another pilot in the area who will become involved, and he's given accolades later as maybe saving lives kind of thing. And if the pilot had given a mayday and it was heard by anybody, there would have been nothing to be said or done by another pilot in the area, which is not to say no one would appreciate what he's done. However, if you want to manipulate a mayday call and say you made it, but you actually didn't, perhaps you were leaving it over to someone else. Now, that's really difficult to say with, again, with as little evidence as we've laid out. However, let me just jump to one thing that we'll see very shortly, and actually I saw it flits by on your screen. That is, this other pilot who eventually came upon the crash does report it and is later given the kudos for possibly having saved lives and kind of thing. But we find out only later that, not through anything he said, by the way, or anyone else has said, at least in the media or any official document that I'm aware of, that this particular pilot who just happened to be in the area within what seems maybe a mile or two, is actually one who has worked for this same commuter airline company that has had the crash. And he's worked hand in glove with these people. That is, it was his director of operations who's put this plane down into the water. It was his boss who owned the airline that contracted with television programs such as Hawaii 5-0 and Lost to provide helicopters, which this particular gentleman flies day in and day out. So he was flying the helicopters of this small aviation company for which both he and his director of operations, the pilot of this crashed Cessna Grand Caravan, worked. So it's just beyond coincidence, we'd have to say, that that would be the person. And of course, not he's not flying his favorite helicopter that day. He's flying in an airplane that he, on Facebook, called the Dusty Crop Hopper, a little clunky 1977 Grumman airplane, which might, and he's got his girlfriend with him, so it might appear to everyone that they're just out joyriding and so forth, but he's there with the video and camera equipment that, you know, real high-end stuff, probably.
Just happens to be in the area.
Was able to take imagery and video of the crash, and that's just kind of very much coincidental, of course.
We're going to see a lot of coincidences develop here, and a lot of people that you wouldn't normally think would be around, including, oh, dare I just tease you a little bit, military, government officials, Hollywood is tied here. Hollywood is tied as, you know, so, okay, Rex, I'm not going to pull you or push you. Go ahead and continue.
Well,
so,
that's interesting you mentioned it. I certainly alluded to it when I said that this particular commuter airline company, at least in its daughter and sister companies, has provided this helicopter support for these various television programs, which, of course, mm-hmm. are doing acting and all kinds of not true-to-life scenes. I mean, they're making them as true-to-life as they can. And these are the experts, the very experts who are involved with that kind of thing, who are involved with this particular crash. So that's just amazing stuff.
And kind of like a Hollywood production. Yes, yes.
It is a Hollywood production, we'll have to say. And that's in the opinion realm at this point, but I can support it, so we'll get there.
Well, just as a legal disclaimer, you know, we are presenting this, the facts here, the documentation, the investigative results here. There's no accusations. Just because we mention someone's name or there are no accusations of criminal conduct here. That's not what we're doing. We're just telling you the findings as Rex has found them and his colleagues, colleague in particular, found these, and you, ladies and gentlemen, make up your mind from the evidence and documentation provided. Again, we're not, you know, we're not making any accusations of criminality. However, you make up your mind. Go ahead, sir.
And you can go to the next slide, which says prohibited EPL manipulation at the top.
It's already there.
And there's a particular lever on the quadrant, so-called throttle quadrant of this airplane that the pilot was flying, the Cessna Grand Caravan. And on the left is an actual image of this, roughly 12 seconds, I believe, after the video began again, subsequent to the claimed catastrophic engine failure. And that leftmost lever, which in a small inset in the, say, left two-thirds of the image of a standard quadrant there, the little red-handled lever, is so-called an emergency power lever. And it's in its standard full aft position all the way back. And the pilot's operating handbook tells one and all that that lever is not to be moved except in the case of a fuel control unit malfunction. Now, if you have catastrophic engine failure and a hammer-like bang and things like that happening, that can pretty well tell you there's nothing wrong with the fuel control unit. And so operating that lever is really prohibited, basically, says the lower section of white. Operation of the emergency power lever is prohibited with the power lever out of the idle position. Well, that black lever is the main power lever, and you can see in the lower left image that he's got both of those out of their idle position, and he's advanced that emergency power lever, which is basically going to flood the engine, probably, but
Rex, where did this image come from? It's a still image on the left hand, folks, for those just listening to this, of the pilot's arm over the main control area there, the operation of the power levers. And, yeah, so where did this image come from on the left there? Because it's
it was
a pilot's
in the videographer's taken, recorded imagery. And
imagine
it's just one
that.
Small frame. Now, he's got a high-definition camera equipment, two of them, redundant, if you will. And that's probably just 5% or so of the full image. So you can imagine the full image is pretty glorious.
No, so, but this is clear that power, the EPL, the emergency power lever is up along with the power lever itself, right? Yeah, so...
Yeah, that's out of the idle position, apparently.
Right, right, okay.
And we can come back to this because it's indicative, once we've seen a lot of evidence of further things going wrong here. So if you want to note that, we can just come back to it later.
So noted.
But we can move on to the next slide for now.
Okay, and the next one is the pilot said, all I know is bang.
Yeah, the engine fire detection system, which is that white portion, is also an excerpt from the pilot's operating handbook. And it tells us basically how the fire warning, which was said to have gone off, would have been operating. That is, there are loops, loops of metal wire, and those are basically set up to be able to detect whether the temperature in a particular area of the engine compartment has gone over a certain number. So if you get near the exhaust, it says, I believe, 450 degrees Fahrenheit. If you were on the firewall, you'd need something 650 degrees Fahrenheit. If you have, well, you can read the numbers there yourself. But those are really pretty high numbers. And it takes that to set off the fire warning. And yet, there's also underlined in red an unusual note, unusual in the sense that it's relevant here. That is, there's a test switch labeled fire detect test located adjacent to the enunciator panel. And when depressed, the engine fire enunciator panel will illuminate. That is, all the little lights of that panel will illuminate as kind of a test. And the horning horn will sound. So there is an artificial way to achieve what the pilot said happened juxtaposed to this bang that he talks of. So the pilot's representation is it's as if this red and yellow light phenomenon and the fire warning horn going off was a natural consequence of this bang. Mm. But there's evidence further that suggests otherwise. Okay. If we look at the very next slide, you'll see above an underwater image of the engine compartment, which has apparently its cowling blown away, probably by water. And there are places that one might look for evidence of a fire. Now, when you're going through the air and you have a fire, that bespeaks smoke. And there's, interestingly, no evidence of smoke that one can see on the engine there at all. And we'll see that's confirmed later by inspection on the salvage barge of the engine. At least with any imagery I've been able to see, one does not see any smoke, which itself doesn't mean anything necessarily.
What Rex is describing here, Rex, I just want to interject this for people listening, is the aircraft is in the water, it's submerged, and the cowling is blown away. The submerged engine, around it shows absolutely no indication of fire, damage, smoke, scorching, or anything like that. And that's what this shows. We're up against the bottom of the hour break. You're listening to Hagman and Hagman. And, folks, let me tell you something. We're rolling out evidence right now, evidence to show that what you've been told about the ostensible death of Loretta Fuddy and the aircraft crash itself is not true. Stay right where you're at. Stay tuned. Talking with Rex.
Rex, an aviation and computer company executive for many years, who has been investigating the strange death of the Obama birth certificate gatekeeper Loretta Fuddy in what was a plane crash, even though that's not the way she perished. Only later, after everybody was taken off the plane, there's some strange videos and other things that have gone around. We've covered this issue extensively. But we have Rex with us, who is getting much more in-depth details, along with visual presentation as well. If you watch us live on YouTube or even catch the archive for the visual presentation. And I'm not sure if we can post the presentation on our website.
No, okay. We're not going to do that, but we will post a recap of this investigation with in coordination with Rex, because this, folks, this is the smoking gun, I believe, that'll blow the lid off everything. Let's get back to Rex. Rex, let's pick right up where you left off.
On that same slide that we were looking at a bit ago, the middle image is of the annunciator panel, and it shows the condition of the lights if there were an engine fire. That is, all those lights are independent, and only the engine fire light at the upper left would come on. Now, in some extreme circumstances, you might have another one or two or three come on. But the pilot's claim was he had an annunciator panel that was nothing but red and yellow lights. And so if one goes through the entire litany of things that could be wrong, but we know weren't wrong, so therefore those lights wouldn't be on, there's very few lights that could even conceivably have been on. And the next slide would show you that if you had literally all the lights that could have come on for any reason, if they had come on as well, you'd see that upper image, and that would be something that would not bespeak a pilot's statement of nothing but red and yellow lights. That is, it's just a small collection of lights. But what he said to happen was that the annunciator panel showed nothing but red and yellow lights. And the fire warning was going off. Well, now the fire warning is another matter. That is, we talked about what it takes to set off the fire warning, but we don't hear on the video's audio track any fire warning going off, which is, of course, anomalous. Why don't we hear it? We hear another warning horn going off. It's very clear. It's very loud, in fact. So why is it we don't hear the fire warning? And I have to qualify that and say, actually, we do hear the fire warning going off. But curiously, it only starts going off 36 seconds after the ditching. We just saw the engine underwater. It would have been immediately robbed of its oxygen. It would have been invaded totally by ocean water. It would have stopped, and we measured it less than 3/10 of a second after hitting the water. Has no oxygen underwater, cannot burn. That is, its appetite for air is so voracious that there's just no time that would be spent in combustion once you hit the water. And immediately, once that engine stops, it's going to be starting its cooling, and around the surrounding water temperature was just like 79 degrees. So all of those criteria that the fire sensor loops had were in the hundreds of degrees, and it only started, that is, the fire warning horn only came on 36 seconds after ditching and went on for another 14 seconds. Now, really, given that evidence, there's really only one possible way that that could have happened, and that is that the pilot, spending his last seconds at the control, had to have pressed that test button, that fire annunciator panel light and fire detect test button. So that would have accomplished what he said, and that is found on the audio track 36 seconds later. And I actually have a friend of mine interviewed one of the passengers who sat in the front row, and he said he saw that panel full of annunciator lights all lit up. So there's confirmation that it happened, but that confirmation is 36 seconds after ditching, which, speaking as a pilot, the only way it could have happened is somebody pressing that button. Those two buttons, I should say.
Gotcha.
And anyway, we can move on.
All right.
And in the next figure, we see something we haven't spoken of yet, that he made, that is, the pilot claimed to have made a passenger briefing. Well, there is no passenger briefing on the audio of the ditching track, at least while they're in the air, and actually for several seconds after that. So it would appear that the pilot didn't really make the claimed briefing that he said he did.
Oh, okay, Rex. When you say briefing, are you saying this is your captain speaking? You know, we'll be flying at an altitude,
yes,
or are you saying,
hey,
brace for impact? I mean,
one of the first slides we looked at, he reported to the U.S. Coast Guard, and he said he prepped the passengers and crew for a water landing and had them don PFDs, which are personal flotation devices. Well, that would be very appropriate. However, if the pilot had done that among his other busy tasks, we would have heard that. If he was on the PA system, we would have heard that. And if he had said that, we very likely would have seen people pull out their flotation devices and put them on. But guess what happens? Nothing. We don't hear any of that. We don't see a single passenger reaching for a life jacket anywhere. And we wouldn't know that except that we actually have video from this videographer. So all of those are very amazing things. And once again, contrary to the very clear evidence that almost cannot lie, you have the evidence in hand that says just that did not happen.
Could not have happened. What you're seeing are these passengers not preparing. I mean, they're going down into the ocean. They're not reaching for a life. Man, I'd be scratching, clawing, you know, for my life jacket, and, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, but you don't see any of that.
And anomalously, we'll see later, and the ABC radio or TV broadcast network showing various clips of this. And in one clip, they say all the passengers know that they're about to go into the water. And another clip says just the opposite, that none of them knew what was about to hit them. So even those two news reports couldn't agree. Maybe they were done by separate groups of people or whatever, but they had the same raw information at hand, presumably. But in any event, there's no audio support for the pilot making any briefing. And he said, supposedly, that he told the passengers to don their life jackets before exiting. Well, we have imagery from the videographer again, and the first six people, none of them are wearing life jackets. Actually, just one is wearing a life jacket, but his life jacket was not inflated, and none of the others had their life jackets on.
So that's a guy listening to Steely Dan in his head headset there, right?
Yeah. He's that is the videographer. But you know, you have to at least ask the question: are these stiff-necked recalcitrants, non-compliant types, and all of them? Is that what we have on this flight? Or maybe there's a pattern here of the pilot saying something and it not being quite the way it really happened. So you have to
there's
process
the evidence,
that
folks.
Information.
Yeah, there's the evidence, or there's the documentation submitted as evidence. You've got a panel, a screen panel there. If you look on YouTube, if you're listening to this via Global Star, BTR, there it is. Yeah, you've got seconds, moments after the landing. One person.
Yeah. All right. You can go to the next slide, and you'll see another statement that the pilot made. He told the assembled press conference on his company's airport offices, he said he told the passengers to stay away from the airplane. Well, there's an image that has literally everyone in the view of the camera's lens. All nine are there, even though the pilot is off there to the left with his single finger. All the passengers, basically all but two of them, the pilot and another guy, are hanging on to the airplane. So you have to ask, did the pilot really tell the people that? And if he did, why don't they listen to the pilot? I mean, I have never seen an aircraft incident where the pilot tells them one command and essentially nobody does what he says. When has that ever happened in your experience? I mean, we've generally all been on airplanes. Yeah. Can you imagine that?
No, it has to be said,
the pilot is saying things that probably would be good to say, but did he really say them, or does it just look good on the record if he says he said them?
Obviously something else is going on here. Yeah. Yeah.
That would be one way to look at it, and maybe, as you use the word nefarious at some point, maybe there's something else going on too. But we can move ahead several slides, maybe to the figure 25, if you can find that.
Oops. And the last frame of the videographer take off?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Good.
Yep.
And here we're looking at the last frame of the so-called takeoff video. That is, the videographer's videos were in two pieces. That is, there's a takeoff portion. And then, as he related in media reports later, he turned off his camera. There was, very soon thereafter, within a few seconds, a bang. And within a couple seconds, couple 3 seconds, he says, he turned his camera back on and just kept on rolling. So this is the last frame of the first portion of that video, and it shows where he is. And we recognize in the far distant view there of the plane's tail portion, we see the cliffs of the northern part of Molokai. So we have a pretty close idea of his direction of flight at that moment, and we of course know where the sun's rays were at that point in time, and that right side image has a yellow arrow saying direction of the sun's rays at that red X. And
so we know
the airplane was headed approximately 320, and that would have put the sun's rays essentially orthogonal to the wings. That is, it would have been off the left wing, pretty much straight on. And the direction of the sun rays in the videographer's camera lens there would have been in that way. Just one added note, if you look at the map, there is a little yellow arrow and arc there from the red X, and that would have been a prudent choice if one considers the wind. That is, he had the wind coming out of the east to turn into the wind if he couldn't make the runway. Would have been the right thing to do. And implicitly, he apparently couldn't make the runway. But maybe some would say he, at 300 feet, 500 feet, it might be difficult, but in fact, we know it was more like 1,000 or more feet. In fact, the videographer later related in a media report that the descent was from between 1,000 and 1,500 feet. Well, that sounds actually very close to the evidence we have in hand. And so maybe that was just a slip-up in disclosing that, as they call it often in legal circles, an admission counter to one's interest. So those are important. But anyway, and this might give us insight as to why the pilots said to the NTSB and the FAA this 300 or 500 foot altitude. Okay. And where we know the plane landed actually was a good distance there. If he could have used that distance to come back to the airport, and even at a fast rate of speed going the opposite way you'd like to, down a runway, you could have at least had good brake friction, and even though you might have overrun the end of the airport or the runway, probably you would have had a lot less damage to the airplane. It might have flown again. The injuries probably would have been less to the passengers, and you could have had rescue crews probably there just that much faster.
All right.
So it's a big question as to why those things unfolded the way they did. But let's move on to the next frame.
Okay, there we go.
And that has first frame of the crash video, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and there we are looking at the direction. There's a yellow arrow again in the upper left map, and at the end of that arrow is an R. That's very close to where we see the plane begins in the second portion, and that was said to have been just a few seconds, so at maximum from what was said, maybe 5 or 6 seconds. And yet, notice how far we are from that red X. So
right.
Some of these representations that have been made are either not accurate or maybe not truthful. And we're also faced in a very different direction by the time that starts. That is, note that direction of the sun's rays. And essentially, the airplane was headed directly into the sun. And we see that by the shadows that are cast. If you move to the next frame, it's kind of a half frame.
Right.
On the right side, you see a yellow line pointed to the edge of the passenger's, or that is the videographer's, window frame. And
yes,
you can see he's just eking a little bit of sun onto that, which means now, after a second of turn to the left, after being head-on into the sun is beginning to break on that window frame. So we know exactly the direction of that flight at the initial portion of the video. And it was very different from the end of the first flight. The sun is in a different position, and we're going to see that the altitude is very different. And that might be a reason that we hear the numbers 300 and 500, because if we are left to calculate, which we can, by the way, the height at that R in the left image where the second crash portion of the video starts, we know that that was approximately 250 feet. So if the pilot says he was at 300 feet when the bang occurs, an aviation person very quickly says, oh yes, of course, you're going to lose a few feet as you have to lower the nose and recover some speed, because if you're climbing out of an airport, you've got the nose high, and you won't be able to maintain that kind of flight attitude without engine power. So you would lose a little feet by having, or several feet, probably in the range of 50 feet, which is very much a coincidence, to say that you'll be at roughly 250 feet. And we know that ditching portion takes almost exactly 30 seconds. So we've been able to calculate. We know the configuration of that airplane. We see imagery of the flap setting and so forth. We know that he was probably maintaining a certain airspeed within the ditching checklist parameters. And we hear the stall warning horn. So we know his configuration pretty closely to be able to say that it was probably 250 feet above the water when that ditching video started. But
all right,
that implies and is very different from where the pilot was when he ended the takeoff segment. Even though he said something different, the evidence is that it was very different. And that's corroborated and confirmed by this great distance from the X, the red X, where the supposed catastrophic engine failure happened, to the R, where he would have continued. So
okay,
how would he have gotten from the X to the R?
All right. So you're showing inconsistencies between the statement and what the video shows, just for the foundational aspects of the listening audience. What you're providing here is documentation that shows, look, what was said and what the video shows. Two dramatically different things, attitude, altitude, distance, all misrepresented or mistakenly provided, right?
Yes.
All right. I just want to make sure that we hit that. This is all important because, you know, it's often said among investigators, non-credentialed investigators, oh, well, you're just throwing stuff out there. No. Look at this. This research is incredibly detailed. Okay, sir. Go ahead.
We can move ahead to the slide that has a litany of other audio anomalies, which shows an audio track as typically represented on a computer. Now, when this ditching portion of the video continues, that is the second portion, as if to corroborate what the witnesses told the police, the witnesses, all that told the police, all that spoke to the police, said that the cabin went quiet. Everything went quiet is what they said. And yet, there's a huge anomaly here. That is, in that ditching video, there's 6 seconds worth of very quiet. The only thing one hears is a rustling of the videographer, apparently, with his camera. And no engine noise, no propeller noise, no nothing. It's very quiet. But then, about 6 seconds into that audio, as if one flipped a switch, you hear an engine noise that's running at better than 15,000 RPM. And you say, how could that be? How in the world could that be? That is, we don't hear an engine spooling up as if restarted by the pilot. I mean, he says he tried to do that, but he failed twice. This is a successful attempt to bring it at least within operating range of 15,000 plus RPM. That's an anomaly. How could that be? And it suggests, and not without other support, that there's other shenanigans going on here. That is, if we look at that moment where the engine appears in the audio, it just is like the flip of a switch. And sure enough, there's a little audio anomaly at that point, which is strong evidence that there were two pieces of audio spliced together. And when you do that and don't have the proper zero crossing and so forth, you're going to get a little glitch. And sure enough, at that very moment, you don't get a spooling up, you get an audio glitch, which, as I say, is evidence to electronic audio editing types that's probably the splicing of two different audios. And that would explain that. But it doesn't explain.
Well, that's further verified by the next slide that shows the white noise, right? The background.
That next slide is a spectrogram of the audio as shown in the Nightline video, which is also further anomalous to this. That is, there's very strange things going on. And if we look at the Nightline audio, there are many things in that audio that don't appear in the NTSB video. And that's also quite perplexing. There's a lot similar, mind you. I'm not saying it's a different piece of audio, but in the Nightline audio, we see other sounds, what I have called a rumbling noise. In fact, two different rumbling noises and kind of an undulating fog of sound in that, and that's kind of what that sonogram shows. But it's also overlaid with narration. There's both a narrator and the videographer speaking throughout that. And it all combines to obfuscate and make difficult to hear what's going on. But these rumbling sounds I mentioned, there are two of them that come in at different points, no obvious juncture. They would, and in fact have been identified even by Cessna Caravan pilots as probably being propeller noise. And yet, there's two of them, and they're at different frequencies. One is three times the other. So there's only one engine on a Cessna Grand Caravan, so they can't be both, at least, propeller noises, because it would be speak two different propeller noises. But we don't need to speculate on that for very long, because the NTSB evidence, that is of the raw audio, doesn't have any rumbling sounds on it whatsoever, and it's clean of the narration obfuscation that one hears only in that segment. So it's fortunate that we can resolve these discrepancies between one and another. However, one does have to ask, why would anyone put in sounds on a potentially, you know, an item or a piece of evidence that is under NTSB investigation? Why would one obfuscate what's going on with such a thing? One would think if you're doing investigative journalism, that you want to get to the nuts and bolts of facts and not do anything that would obfuscate anything. But unfortunately, what we're talking about is not just one little thing. This is, in fact, just evidence, one piece of evidence of a type of things that happens again and again.
Rex, I got to stop you right there because we're heading toward the top of the hour here. Let me ask you this. Okay. Can you stay with us just for a few more minutes here? Because you're coming back tomorrow, but I don't want to leave this. Okay, yeah. Folks, you're seeing the this is evidence documentation that nothing is as it was presented to be. Our guest is Rex. He's an aviation and computer expert, nearly 30 years in the aviation industry, pilot as well. Pilot certified as a pilot in multi and single engine aircraft, laying out the groundwork, the necessary, tedious, yes, but necessary groundwork to show that he's got the evidence from his investigation and along with his colleague, Butter D. Zillion, but combining, I mean, you're getting it first here. This is the evidence that things are not right.
That's right. And we'll be back with Rex right after these short messages. Just a quick announcement. Thursday, we have Dr. Michael Lake. Friday, Dr. Ted Broder. And tomorrow, Rex will be back with us, as well as right after this break. Stay with us.